But, you know, if your job is over here and it's what you do to pay the bills, but your passion or your purpose is writing or podcasting or volunteering or whatever it is, whatever that purpose is, that's what your life should be about, finding that purpose and living it. Because if you do that at the end of your life, you're going to be a whole lot happier and a whole lot more at peace.
Welcome to Chasing Leviathan. I'm here today with Terry Tucker. He's the founder of Motivational Check and author of Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles for Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. Terry, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk to you.
And today we're going to be talking about how do we handle suffering? Specifically, how do we handle the loss of our health? Because I think a lot of times we like to skip to the suffering that we've experienced, but I'd love to hear a little bit about you, Terry. I read your bio, but for our listeners, what unique experience do you have that lets you speak directly to this topic?
So let me kind of give you a Reader's Digest version of my life. I'm 60 years old, and it won't take me that long to do it, I promise. But I'm the oldest of three boys. You cannot tell this from looking at me, but I'm 6'8" tall, and I played college basketball at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. I have a brother who's 6'7" who pitched for Notre Dame. And then I have another brother who's 6'6" who was drafted by the Cleveland Cavaliers in the National Basketball Association. And then my dad was 6'5". So if you sat behind our family in church growing up, not a prayer's chance you were going to see anything that was going on in front of us. So anyway, after I graduated from college, I was actually the first person in my family to graduate from college. And I moved home to find a job. I was all set to, you know, make my mark on the world with my newly obtained business administration degree. And I look back now and realize what a knucklehead I was to think I knew anything about business just because I had a degree. Fortunately, I was able to find that first job. It was in the corporate headquarters of Wendy's International, the hamburger chain, in their marketing department. But unfortunately, I ended up living with my parents for the next 3.5 years as I helped my mom care for my father and my grandmother, who were both dying of different forms of cancer. Mm-hmm. In my professional career, as I said, I was in marketing. I was a hospital administrator. I was a police officer, and I did undercover narcotic work. And I was also a SWAT team hostage negotiator. I was also a school security consultant, girls high school basketball coach, a motivational speaker. Last year, I became an author. But for the last 9 years, I've considered myself a cancer warrior because I've been battling this very rare form of melanoma. And then just to wrap this part up, my wife and I have been married for almost 28 years. We have one child, a daughter who's a graduate of the United States Air Force Academy and is a lieutenant in the newly formed branch of the military, the Space Force. So that's kind of me in a nutshell.
It's awesome. Yeah. I love the diversity of all the jobs you mentioned. Like, I wonder what kind of carryover you had from hostage and negotiator to girls basketball coach. You know, like, this seems like it'd be some interesting parallels.
Yeah, you learn a lot.
Yeah, man. Even I'm reading. You know, I have a 3- and 6-year-old. We actually just moved in. My parents moved in with us. We're trying to do the multi-generational thing, and it's really been a really sweet thing. And around the same time, my grandma has developed dementia, and they just moved down the street. So we do, it's not full-time care, but like, it's every day we're helping over there. We're doing different things. Not that my story is the same, obviously, but just like there's some touch points there that I can appreciate. So as you're talking about your cancer, like, can you talk a little bit about what that felt like first finding out and what you've learned along the way about handling that loss of your health?
Sure. So this was 2012. And at the time I mentioned I was a girls' high school basketball coach, and I had a callus break open on the bottom of my foot. And I didn't think much of it because I was on my feet a lot. You know, as a coach, you're on your feet quite a bit. But when it didn't heal after a couple of weeks, I went to see a podiatrist, a foot doctor friend of mine, and he took an x-ray and he's like, you know, I think you have a little cyst in there, but, and I can cut it out. And he did. And he showed it to me. It was just a little gelatin sack with some white fat in it. He's like, I've seen thousands of these, nothing to worry about. Well, 2 weeks later, I get the call from him. And as I said, he was a friend. And the more difficulty he was having explaining what was going on, the more frightened I became. And so finally, he just kind of laid it out. He said, Terry, I've been a doctor for 25 years, and I've never seen this form of cancer. You have a rare form of melanoma that most of us think of melanoma as a skin disease, you know, a dark spot on our skin or something like that. There's a rarer form of melanoma, which I have, which appears on the bottom of your feet or the palms of your hands. And then there's an even rarer form of melanoma that appears in our mucous membrane, so in our nose or our mouth or something like that, but it's still melanoma. So he said, you know, I'd recommend you go to MD Anderson, which is probably one of the premier cancer hospitals, probably in the world, and certainly in the United States, and be treated. And so I did. And I had a surgery to remove the tumor on the bottom of my foot. And then I had another surgery to remove all the lymph nodes in my groin. And then when I healed, I was put on a weekly injection of a drug called interferon, which for me was just, it was a horrible, nasty, debilitating drug. And basically what it did was it gave me severe flu-like symptoms for 2 to 3 days every week after each injection.
Wow.
And I took those weekly injections for almost 5 years. Yeah. So imagine having the flu every week for 5 years. And that's just to keep the disease from coming back. That wasn't a cure. The disease did come back when that was stopped. 2017, 2018, I had my left foot amputated. 2019, it came back again with two more surgeries in my shin. And then last year, an undiagnosed tumor in my ankle grew large enough that it fractured my tibia, my shin bone. And the only recourse I had at that point was to have my left leg amputated right in the middle of this global pandemic. And I also found out I had tumors in my lungs. So that's kind of my cancer progression for the last 9 years. And I've learned a lot over this time. You know, I've learned that, you know, the limits that we have in our life are the limits that we place on ourselves, that we have, we can do so much more than we ever thought we could do. I'm reminded there was a study back in the 1950s at Harvard that was done by a man who took mice and he put them in water over their head. And they treaded water for about 15 minutes before they started to sink. And right before they started to sink, he pulled them out, dried them off, let them rest for a while, and then put them back in the tank. And you would think that, well, what would happen next? Well, they'd go another 15 minutes and they would, you know, then start to sink. Well, they didn't. They went for another 60 hours before they sunk because they knew somebody was going to rescue them. They knew somebody would come and help them. So you can imagine, you know, at 15 minutes you're sinking and then somebody helps you out. And then you think, oh, it's going to happen again. So I'm going to keep going. Can you imagine how much more your body could do? Then, you know, we always get to that end of the road. Oh, I can't do anymore. Your body can do so much more than you ever thought it could.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you're familiar with Jocko Willink.
Yeah. The former Navy SEAL.
Yes. Was a rebuke to me because I am pretty lazy about exercise, but his statement, one of the things they say is that the 40% rule, that most people hit their wall at 40% of what their body's actually capable of. And that's when they give up. I mean, I think that correlates what you're talking about, right?
Absolutely.
Why do we place those limits?
I think our brains place those limits, you know, and if you think about it, I mean, I've always said this, everything you need to be successful in life, however you define that for yourself, is already inside you. It's already there. You just need to find it and pull it out. But what happens is, and we know this, you know, to the brain, the status quo, the way things are now is good. It's comfortable. Just don't mess with it. Leave it alone. So every time you want to step outside that comfort zone, whether, you know, I want to look for a new job, or, you know, you get up this morning and I'm sure you probably wouldn't do this with two little kids and say, hey, I'm going to go skydiving or something like that. You know, it would be like your brain is going to kick in and it would be like, you know, PJ, skydiving. No. The plane might crash or your parachute may not. That's your brain kicking in and putting all those negative thoughts because you're stepping outside your comfort zone. The problem is the only way we can grow is to step outside that comfort zone, to do things that scare us. And I always tell, especially young people when I talk to them, if you have a passion for something in your heart, but it scares you, go ahead and do it. Because at the end of your life, the things that you're going to regret are not going to be the things that you did. They're going to be the things that you didn't do. Yeah. And by then it's going to be too late to go back and do them.
Yeah. And always keeping like those passions and those priorities in mind, because I've never heard a single deathbed story where someone's like, man, I wish I'd spent more time at work. You know what I mean? Like family, skydiving, all those kind of regrets really come from that staying in what's comfortable and just like, and sticking to, I mean, there's value in routine, but it should be targeted. It should be prioritized.
Yeah, it's kind of the old Shawshank Redemption movie about, you know, get busy living or get busy dying. Yeah, you know, I mean, really, that's kind of what we're talking about. I mean, if you're doing the same thing every day, and I know these people, you probably know them too. They get up at the same time, they eat the same breakfast, they drive to work the same way. That, you know, they come home, they eat dinner, they watch TV, and they go to bed every single day. Those people are dead already. They just haven't fallen over yet because they're not growing. They're not doing anything to improve themselves. So I always tell, like I said, especially young people, whatever is it out there that, you know, find that passion in your heart. And like you said, I don't want people to think that their passion or their purpose or their why, whatever you want to call it, has to be their job. It doesn't.
Right.
I mean, you know, it can be, but you know, if your job is over here and it's what you do to pay the bills, but your passion or your purpose is writing or podcasting or volunteering or whatever it is, whatever that purpose is, that's what your life should be about, finding that purpose and living it. Because if you do that at the end of your life, you're going to be a whole lot happier and a whole lot more at peace.
And I think something that you said there, that you'll end up happier, is huge, because one of the earliest things I figured out was if I pursued happiness, I didn't find it. But if I pursued purpose, it might be hard at first, but I got more lasting happiness that way.
Yeah, because that's what you were put here to do. I mean, that was the reason. I don't want to put my faith on anybody, but I always talk about, you know, what's gotten me through cancer, several things. But one of the things is what I call the three F's: faith, family, and friends. And, you know, and I believe that we're all put here for a reason. And I want to find that purpose. I don't want to live it. And there's an old Native American Blackfoot proverb that goes, when you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a way so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. That's what I want.
That's a good one.
I want to be the end of my life to be that. Yeah. You know, it's a great life. Now it's time to move on to whatever's next.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really, I'm definitely going to steal that. That's great.
Feel free. A lot of people do. So.
So how do people, and I think this is, you know, we're talking about these limits and the comfort zone. How do people take their bodies for granted? And how does that hinder them?
You know, one of the things that I learned being a police officer, because I saw a lot of people shot, to be honest with you. I work kind of a not so great area. And I've seen people literally shot, you know, four or five times in the torso, up, walking around, talking, you know, things like that. The interesting thing about our bodies, I think when God created them, you know, for the most part, you know, there's a lot of redundancy. You know, if you lose a lung, you got another lung. If you lose a kidney, you got another kidney. You know, I mean, there's a lot of redundancy in that. And I've just seen the human body take so much damage and still be able to go on. But I think that's the problem. We think that, you know, we can eat chips and burgers and, you know, and all that kind of stuff constantly. And you know, it's kind of garbage in, garbage out. You know, if you don't put the right things in your body, and I always tried to do this, and But, you know, like one of the things, for example, one of the diagnostic tools my doctor used for many years with my cancer was what was called a PET scan. And don't ask me what PET stands for, because it's about that long. But basically what it is they inject radioactive sugar into your body with the idea that cancer cells have a higher metabolism than your normal cells, and they will pick it up faster, and it will glow on the scan. And that's what it does. So, I mean, I'm not the brightest bear in the woods, but, you know, I got to the point where, yeah, sugar, probably not a good idea, you know, when you have cancer, to be eating a lot of sugar. But I mean, let's face it, most of what we eat has sugar in it anyway. I just try to limit the amount of intake of sugar that I do. So I think it's important for people to realize that, yeah, your body can take a lot of damage, but sooner or later, that's going to catch up with you, whether it's you don't exercise, or, you know, you lead a sedentary lifestyle, or you eat poorly or whatever. I mean, my God, it's 2021. We know how to be healthy. It's just your choice to not be that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are definitely people who don't have that choice, but if you're listening to this podcast, you probably have the tools to be healthy. If you have the tools to listen to a podcast and the time, you probably have those things. And that's a really, but it takes discipline. It takes going out of your comfort zone. I mean, literally, I mean, that when you talk about sugar, it is addicting, right? So it's like, yeah, it's easier. That's what we learn about addicts, is it's easier to stay in the addiction than to move out, because that's painful. How has suffering taught and grown you as a person?
I guess I'm going to take exception to what you just said. I'm going to say about that. Pain in our lives is inevitable. We're all going to have pain. And you know, for me, it's cancer pain. It doesn't have to be that pronounced. I mean, it could be, you know, you flunk a test at school, or you break up with your boyfriend or your girlfriend, or you don't get the assignment that you want at work. Whatever it ends up being, we're all going to experience pain. Pain is inevitable. Suffering, on the other hand, I believe is optional.
Gotcha.
It's what you do with that pain. Do you sit down there in the guck and the muck, you know, in the garbage, and feel sorry for yourself and want other people to feel sorry for you? That's suffering. Or do you take that pain, flip it inside, use it as energy, burn it as fuel, whatever you want to say, to make you stronger, to make you tougher, to make you more determined? That's how I've survived 9 years of this cancer. And, you know, a constant, I kind of always joke with my orthopedic surgeon that you're sort of piecemealing me to hell one body part at a time. You know, it's like, here's a foot, you know, here's a leg kind of thing, you know, and you kind of have to joke about it. But I mean, I think that's really what's important, that you have to take control of this. And you can't, you know, I always say that I want my life to be lived based on the decisions that I make, not based on the decisions that I didn't make or that other people made for me. So I think it's important to really be present, to be, you know, kind of in that moment. And PJ, I'll be honest with you, what I was just going to say went right out of my head.
No worries. That was, I mean, what you said
was good. That's what happens when you get old.
You talk about using pain as fuel, and maybe another way of even phrasing it, if I'm tracking with you, is using pain as an opportunity, because we can create our own opportunities to step outside our comfort zones, or we can take pain and, instead of retreating, using that as an opportunity to step outside. And is that another way of thinking about that fuel comparison?
It is, in a way. I mean, I always say that. So pain for all of us is going to end eventually. You know, it may end for me through surgery. It may end through medication. Quite frankly, it may end because I die. But if I quit, or I give up, or I give into that, I will always have pain. Won't be the same kind of pain, but that pain will always follow me. So from my perspective, I just don't quit. I just don't lay down and say it's over. Now, don't get me wrong. I think everybody has a breaking point. I think everybody, you know, has something that, you know, I just can't take it anymore. I don't care how tough you are. I don't care, you know, how tough of a Navy SEAL you are. There's a point. I when I was in college, there was a man by the name of James Stockdale. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but
vaguely ringing some bells.
Pardon me?
Vaguely ringing some bells, but
okay. So a couple of things about Stockdale. He was a Naval Academy grad. He was shot down over Vietnam, and he was the highest ranking officer in the Hanoi Hilton as a prisoner of war. And literally, he's a Medal of Honor winner. He was the president of, I went to a military college in South Carolina called the Citadel. He was the president of that college. His leg had been fused together because his knee broke when he ejected. I mean, the Vietnamese wanted to use him as propaganda. The night before the press conference, he beat himself with a chair leg so badly that they couldn't do it because it would be like, oh, you're beating me. I mean, this man was just in terms of toughness, I'd put up against any Navy SEAL in the world. I mean, this guy was just amazing. Yeah. And eventually went on to be the vice presidential candidate of a man by the name of Ross Perot, who ran for president of the United States. But just a real cerebral kind of guy. You know, I mean, I always used to kind of tease, you know, it's kind of like he was a guy who walked around and be like, why is there air?
Yeah, you know,
it's like, you know, and as a basketball player, you know, it's like, well, there's air to blow up basketballs and, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, so we know where there's air.
Yeah, of course.
But he was just a tough guy. And actually, he and his wife wrote a book called In Love and War. And he writes a chapter and then she writes a chapter. And it kind of chronicles their time, his time being a prisoner of war, and how she would write him letters. And the letters were coded. So there were codes within the letters that he would understand and things like that. So it's really a great book. I mean, I was fascinated by it. But it's just, you know, we all experience that pain and we all want to give up, but that's one thing about pain is if you've got it, you know, you're still alive, you know, you're still living, you know, you still are here. You know, you don't have it. Maybe you're not here anymore.
Yeah. I mean, sorry, let me digest that for a second. Yeah. And I think that's just really, that's a really important point is that, I mean, you're never going to live a life free of pain. Like you said, it's inevitable. So seeing that as just a gift and a sign is a really, I love that perspective.
Well, I think I've heard Jocko talk about, you know, when bad things happen to you, his response is always good.
Yeah.
You know, something good, something bad happened to you. Now you can make something good out of that. You can learn something. You can take another path, whatever it is. So we all like, oh God, this is horrible. This is tragic. What if we just said, yeah, good. I got fired. Good. Gives me a chance to, you know, I didn't like this job so much, or I'm going to go somewhere else and, you know, go work for a competitor and I'll show you, you shouldn't have fired me and whatever it is, you know?
Yeah. I remember, I was a teacher and it was not what I thought it was going to be. You know, the education system in America, I have strong opinions about that, but I got let go. And I had promised to stay at that school for 3 to 5 years. So I felt kind of trapped because I was going to say, and then when they let me go, my first, like just this huge emotional wave of relief was my first and I was like, it's one of the best things that ever happened to me. Cause they'd like, I've moved on. I'm doing other things. It fits my gifts better because I thought I was supposed to take a certain path and that path opened up. And you're absolutely right. Returning to something you mentioned, faith, family, and friends, and, it seems there's a relationship there between that and purpose, because you also talked about your purpose is what helps shape how you do that. Can you talk a little about how your faith has impacted your journey?
Sure. I've been asked that question a lot, and maybe in a different format, sort of, do you blame God because you got cancer, because you've been through this 9 years? And I don't. I never have. And I've never once said, you know, why me? And I kind of look at that as, you know, especially like, you know, when people ask me, I'm like, no, I don't think God got up on Tuesday morning and looked at his to-do list and said, Terry Tucker, cancer today. You know, I don't think God did that.
Yeah.
But God certainly has given me the fortitude, the resolve to go on during some really, really, really bad times. I always remember that Winston Churchill quote that goes, you know, when you're going through hell, keep going. You know, that's kind of the way I felt in a lot of ways. And I just didn't feel that I was able to do it alone. And there have been times in my life when I was at the Citadel, I had a full scholarship to play basketball, but I'd never been away from home really in my life. And here I was in Charleston, South Carolina with my head shaved and I'm marching and I'm doing all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, no, I came here to play basketball, you know, not to do all this stuff. And I was going to quit. I never quit anything in my life. I was walking over to tell the coaches I was going to leave. And I thought, you know, before I do that, I'm going to go check my mail. And I happened to have a 7-page handwritten letter from my father that basically said, you know, pull your head out, I mean, he was like, you know, I love you. I'm proud of you. You've overcome 3 knee surgeries in high school to get to this point. You know, you have a full scholarship for the rest of your life. And, you know, and then he kind of hit me with the big thing. He said, you know, you've called home 7 times since you've been down there. And not once have you ever asked about how anybody here is doing. Mm-hmm. You are so in your head right now. Get out of it.
Yeah.
Get out of your head. And that was just such an important lesson. And I really think, you know, I take the letter, I go up to the, you know, rafters of the field house. I read this letter. I'm crying like a baby. I'm going to quit. But I think God kind of put that in my path and said, hey, here's an option. Maybe don't quit.
Yeah.
You know, it's your choice. You have the choice to do whatever you want. You have the choice to quit and go home, or you have the choice to stick it out and get a, you know, a college education. And like I said, I was the first person in my family to graduate from college. So I did. I mean, I couldn't let my father down,
yeah.
You know, but yeah. I think God puts, you know, there's that old joke about when we talk to God, it's called prayer. When God talks to us, it's called schizophrenia. So, I mean, God has never talked to me,
yeah.
But I think God has put people in my path that have said, hey, Terry, you ought to write a book. Hey, Terry, you ought to start a blog. Hey, Terry, you ought to write a book. Hey, Terry, you know, and when that happens, I think I'm smart enough to sort of perk up and say, maybe there's something here. You know, maybe that's God's way of trying to get me to do something.
And so for you, when you're talking about, you know, the 3 things, the 3 F's, like faith, family, and friends, you see those all closely interconnected.
You know, I do, because they all begin with the letter F, my family, faith has always been a big part in my family growing up.
Yeah.
It's been a big part of my family now, my wife and my daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, I could not have gotten through these 9 years without them, my friends. And I think when you have a chronic or a terminal type of disease, you really kind of find out who your friends are. You really find out who, you know, who wants to be down here in the trenches with you. And I remember when I had my first surgery, I did not have to stay in the hospital. I was allowed to go home when I woke up, and I got home, and I'd been home about 30 minutes, and my cell phone rings, and it's my 93-year-old friend who'd been in World War II. And he's on, he's like, Terry, can I come over for just 10 minutes? I know you just got over from the hospital, but can I come over for 10 minutes? And his name was Bud. I said, sure, Bud, come on over. Within 15 minutes, here's Bud standing in, you know, in our living room with a fully cooked chicken and a pan of cream cheese Danish for the, you know, he's like, here, you've got dinner for tonight and you've got breakfast for the morning. And the one thing that I learned, and that I was certainly have been guilty of, and you probably have too. How many times when somebody's going into the hospital, there's some event going on, and you always say, hey, if you need anything, let me know.
Yeah.
And what I've learned is that is such a cop-out. You know, that's like being on the sidelines and trying to convince yourself you're playing in the game.
Yeah.
You're not.
Yeah.
You know, the same things that you need to have done at your house, you know, the garbage needs to go out, the grass needs to be mowed, the dog needs to be walked, groceries need to be gone. Those are the same things I need to have done at my house, but I'm going to go have surgery. Or maybe it's even something good, like you're going to have a baby or something like that. Don't sit back and wait. Get involved. You know, I'm going to pick up some food for you. Here you go. You know, maybe not be stuff that you guys normally eat, but you've got dinner for tonight or something like that. Again, don't sit on the sidelines and try to convince yourself you're playing in the game by, hey, if you need anything, let me know, because I am too busy and there's too much going on in my life for me to figure out how you can help me.
Yeah. Instead of presenting people with problems, presenting them with solutions.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's something that I've slowly been growing in, because I've definitely been guilty of saying, hey, you know, let me know if you need anything. And instead saying, hey, let me know if you need anything for instance, I love to cook, would love to get you dinner, you know, and depending on the how close I am, the relationship, maybe showing up with dinner, right? You know, like sometimes you show up with dinner and they're like, well, we already had plans and this is awkward. Yeah. But I mean, like,
coming with a solution. Have a nice day.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. And how do we keep that perspective in the midst of suffering? And I think you've even mentioned a little bit about breaking points and that, and I think I, you know, reading your bio, I noticed this, that you had moments when you said you were praying that you would die. And just, I think sometimes people read incredible stories or hear about incredible stories like yours, and they think, wow, this person's so tough. And then just realizing that, like, it's okay to have breaking points. The important thing is to come back. And how do you come back? How do you keep perspective in the midst of pain like this? Not suffering. I learned my lesson this time. But
well, and that's a great point, because I don't want your audience to think that, you know, there's an S on my chest or I wear a cape or anything like that. There isn't. I have bad days just like everybody else. The last time I had treatment, I remember I'm sitting there in the dark, I'm shaking, I'm throwing up, I'm feeling, and I'm just crying, you know, and it's just like, I'm just depleted. I am, you know, and I had a nurse come over and put her arm around me, you know, and just like, hey, you know, so yes, I have bad days. I'll guarantee you this Sunday, cause I start treatment again on Monday. Mm. I'll say to my wife, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do it. I mean, don't think I'm, you know, yeah, I can't wait to go and get stuck with a needle 50 times or something. Yeah, you know, no, I don't like any of this stuff either, but I know darn well, I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and we're going to be at the hospital by 6, and it's going to, you know, it's going to be an all day event. And it's, that's the way it's going to be for the week. And that's, you just know that going into it, you know, yeah. You just know that that's the way it's going to be, and you have to deal with it. So, I mean, I always talk about like the things that have gotten me through certainly the 3 F's, but I always talk about my 4 truths. Yeah. And those are things that, I've mentioned them, a couple of them before, but I'll give them to you. Cause yeah. I have them on a post-it note right here that I'm looking at, and I see multiple times during the day. And I think that's another thing. If there's something, you know, that you feel passionate about, some goal you have or something, write it down and stick it somewhere where you're going to see it every day, you know, stick it on your bathroom mirror or, you know, I mean, I don't think my wife would let me do that, but you know, I mean, stick it somewhere where, you know, where you're going to see it, where it's going to remind you every single day. So anyway, 4 truths. First one, control your mind or it will control you. You know, our brains can hold one thought at a time. Why would you make that a negative thought? Why would you want to say, you know, I'm not good enough or I suck or I'm dying or whatever? No, you know what? Flip that around. But the most important thing about that is that you need to recognize those thoughts are there. You need to recognize that, that's not something good. I want my, you know, no, flip that. No, here's something positive. And I know when I had my knee surgeries in high school, when I missed an entire year playing, and my brain was like, you know, you're probably a step slower or coaches aren't going to be interested in recruiting you. That's what was going on in my head. And I had to flip that. It's like, oh, no, wait a minute. I'm still playing at an elite level. You know, I still have coaches calling me, wanting me to. So no, you've got to flip that around, flip that switch. So that's number one, control your mind. Number two, we talked a little bit about embracing the pain and the discomfort that we all experience in life and using it to make you a stronger, a tougher, a more determined individual. And we talked about, you know, embracing the pain and turning it inside and things like that. So that's number two. Number three is one that I've added just recently. And I think it's important for us, all of us, to look at the end game. You know, what are people going to say about you at your funeral? You know, are your ancestors going to be proud of the life that you have lived? And I think it's important, especially when you're young, to think about that now, because if you don't like what's going to be said about you, then you have time to change it. But I want to kind of put a caveat on here. I'm not telling you've got to live your life for somebody else. You don't. You need to live your life on your terms. But, you know, if people are like, you know, Terry's really a jerk. You know, I don't want people saying that at my funeral. Why is Terry a jerk? Why are people saying that? So you have time to kind of massage yourself, work on yourself a little bit. But so here's number three, what we leave behind is what we weave in the hearts of other people. And I that's really about your legacy. And I had a story recently, I had a nurse at the hospital who came to me one day and said, and I had met her originally when she was in training and I had just started my therapy, and my therapy is pretty aggressive and it's pretty ugly. And this was months later, and she was taking care of me full time then. And she said, "Terry, I want to tell you a story, but I'm really nervous about telling you." And she actually left. And she's like, "I'll come back later and tell you." And she did. Yeah. And she's young. She was about 25. She said, "When I met you, I was going to leave nursing. I was going to get out of this profession. I'd had a friend of mine, was a very close friend, die. I was in a dark place. I talked to my mom and dad. I was going to quit nursing. I was going to work for Amazon. And then I met you and I saw what you go through every single day. And just watching you, how you conduct yourself, how you lead your life, how you deal with this, I knew I was in the right place. I knew I was doing what I needed to do." Now, if she would have never told me that story, I would have had no idea that my life had an impact on her. I think those people are all over the world. I think people are looking at PJ and saying, "You know what? PJ's a pretty cool guy. I want to be like," you'll never know who those people are.
Yeah.
I mean, you talked about when you were a teacher, you know, how many kids did you have influence on that you had no idea whether they told you, they didn't tell you, whatever it is. I have no idea had an influence on that kid. So there's an old John Wooden saying that goes, "A careful person I want to be, a little person follows me. I dare not go astray for fear they may go the same way." So that's number three. Number four is pretty self-explanatory. As long as you don't quit, you can never be defeated. And I think that goes back to talking about, you know, pain will eventually go away in some form. But if you quit, if you give up, if you give in, that pain or pain will always be with you. So those are kind of the four truths. And I try to live my life with my faith and those four things that I've learned over the last 9 years.
If you don't feel comfortable answering this, feel free.
Ask me anything you want.
As you're talking through, you know, the weaving into other people's life, that idea of end game, that idea of if you don't quit, you will never be defeated. Is there a concept of a good death that is woven into all this?
I think so. When I found out that my leg had to be amputated and before I started the chemotherapy, I went with my wife to the funeral home, to the cemetery, to the church, and I planned my entire funeral. And it's funny because I got some kind of brushback from a lot of people, like, you know, "Don't you think that's defeatist?" And, you know, and I kind of looked at them like, "Well, last time I checked, we're all going to die." You know, I don't think anybody's working on a cure for life right now. Yeah. But, you know, I said, "No, I don't think that's defeatist. I had to go with my mother to do all those things after my father died, after being up all night, after being exhausted, you know, mentally drained, and do that." So I thought, if I do this now, when it happens, and more than likely it's going to happen relatively soon, all they have to do is make a phone call and it's all taken care of. All that ridiculous, tough, hard things that you have to do are done. They're all done. So no, I don't think it's defeatist. We're all going to die, but we're not all going to really live. And I think that's what's important. It's not the death part of it. It's the life part of it. And I don't know why people are so afraid to die. I'm almost, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I mean, I'm not hastening it. I don't want it to happen, but I know it's going to. So I'm almost kind of excited to see what's on the other side of this life. You know, it's kind of the old Star Trek thing, you know, "Captain, what's our course?" You know, out there. I want to go out there. Yeah. I want to see what's out there, and hopefully it will be a wonderful, amazing, great thing.
Do you think that accepting that death is going to happen, which you obviously have done, and it's inspiring to me, is an important part of starting to really live?
I think, yes, I think, you know, it's inevitable. I don't, like I said, I don't know why people get all excited about it. I mean, we see it every year. I mean, we see it, you know, in the spring, the flowers come out, and in summer's night, and then in the fall and the winter, it's gloomy and it's dark and things die. And we see it every year, but we're afraid of it. It happens every year. you know, it, no matter what climate you're in, no matter where you live. So yes, I think it's important. I think it's easier to accept your death if you actually live your life, if you actually live your purpose. It's so much
flip
easier
it the other way. Yeah,
exactly. Because I think people that, and I've seen a lot of people die as a policeman, and certainly the number of people that I've known during my cancer journey, I've seen a lot of people die. And I'm going to make a huge generalization here, but I think the people who die what you and I would probably call peaceful deaths are those people who found their purpose in life and they lived it. Mm. Whereas the people who, you know, go kicking and screaming, you know, I want another day, I want another month, I want another year. Those are people, and again, huge generalization, that seem to have never done anything with their life. They just kind of muddled through life. And I think the problem is we live, or not everybody, it's very easy to live a casual life, to not really figure out what your purpose is. And by living a casual life, your dreams, your goals, your ambitions become a casualty of that unplanned living. So it's important. It's important for the end game, but it's important, you know, in your life to figure out why you're here and what you're supposed to do with that.
Absolutely. And you've talked here about, even as we talk about that weaving, communities come up several points here. One, it sounds like that end game is involved in what you weave into other people's lives. As we talk about accepting death, some of that is you have this kind of, could I say, generational mindset of like what your purpose is beyond yourself. So the end of yourself is not the end even of your purpose. And so you have something you're working towards outside of yourself. And that's part of what makes that. That's where the living helps with, it leads to accepting, if that makes sense. And yeah, that's what helps you handle the pain.
Exactly. I've been asked about this clinical trial I'm on. And what I've tried to explain is certainly, yes, I hope this trial works for me. But again, I look at it as it's something bigger than me, because the doctors are gleaning data from, you know, all these tests and blood work and everything they do from me that maybe I'll never benefit from, but maybe somebody 5 years from now or 10 years from now will benefit, because there'll be a drug that comes out of this that can save their life and they can be with their family. So this isn't necessarily just about me. And that's one thing I think being an athlete and being involved in team sports, you know, especially, I mean, you know, I started playing basketball at 9 and played it all the way up, you know, till I was 21. You realize that you're part of a team. And if you don't do your job, then you're not only letting yourself down, but you're letting your teammates down, your coaches down, your fans down, and things like that. And if you think about it, the biggest team game that we all play is the game of life. And, you know, you are just one part of that big team. And, you know, you may say, who cares? You know, if I don't do my part, it's not a big deal. It is a big deal. It is. There's that domino effect that, again, you may never know who that person is. You may never know that, hey, this person looks up to me, you know, and I totally messed up here. And now they're thinking, maybe that's okay. Maybe I should do that. Maybe morals and ethics and integrity and things like that, maybe they're not so important. No, they are. And you're setting the example.
Yeah. And we've talked about weaving out into other people's lives, but I mean, it's pretty clear that your vision of this includes being woven into. And that's where, when we talked about breaking points, when you talked about what brought you through, it's other people weaving into your life.
It is. It's totally. And that's totally it. And being open to allowing people to help you when you need help. You know, like I said, you know, here I am sitting in a dark room, throwing up, crying, shaking, and a nurse just puts her arm around me. You know, I'm like, okay, that, you know, I could be, oh no, I'm tough. You know, you don't do that. No, I'm not that tough. Sorry. You know, I mean, every now and then I need somebody to give me a good hug or something like that. And you know, in 1993, Jim Valvano at North Carolina State had that great speech where he was dying, you know, and he gave it at the ESPYs when he won the award for courage. And I didn't understand it in 93, but, you know, having lost my foot and my leg, where he talked about, you know, cancer can take all my faculties, but it can't touch my mind. It can't touch my heart and it can't touch my soul. I get that now. Yeah. That's who I am. This is just a facade. This is just a vessel to hold that. So that's not really who I am. So, you know, you want to cut more stuff off, cut it off. That I'll find a way to make this work. And that's not the kind, that's not who Terry Tucker is. Who Terry Tucker is my mind, my heart, and my soul.
And what you've woven into other people even.
Yeah. And what they've woven into me. Yeah.
Something I read in your bio that I found really interesting, just segueing into maybe a slightly different thing here. Do you mind talking about your experience with interferon? Because I saw that, I mean, I'll be honest, I've never heard of anyone getting 108 degree fever. I haven't even heard of that, much less surviving it. And so, I mean, like you mentioned in passing, and I'm sure any listener, you know, they might've caught that and been interested. Okay. You know, you're taking this medicine and it's supposed to stop from coming back. Then you stop taking it. Why? And having read your bio, I know a little bit about that, but it seems like there are things that are really important in terms of how we think about our health, with that whole situation.
Yeah. So again, you know, when my oncologist said, you know, I would like you to go on interferon, I'm like, interferon, I don't really know much about it, but I actually, one of the grandmother of one of my players was taking it for hepatitis. Hmm. So I asked her about it. I'm like, you're on this. What do you think? And she's like, it's pretty nasty, but you know, I'm only taking it for like 6 months. And I thought, yeah, okay. If grandma can do it, yeah, I can do it. You know. I mean, I was still in pretty good shape and all that. And so I went back to the oncologist. I'm like, you know, I talked to one of my players' grandmothers and she's taking it for 6 months. You know, I'm sure I could take it for 6 months. And my oncologist kind of looks at me and she's like, I'd like you to take it for 5 years. I said, wait a minute. You want me to have the flu every week for 2 or 3 days for 5 years? It's like, if you can. I'm like, are you nuts? I mean, that's exactly what I said to her. I'm like, are you nuts? That just doesn't seem like anything irrational. I don't care how tough you are. I don't care how strong you are. How can you possibly ask? She's like, do the best you can. So
fair enough.
That's what she said.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like you to be on it as long as you can. There will be a time when it will become so toxic to your body that you'll have to go off it. And for me, that was what you just described. I ended up in the intensive care unit with a fever of 108 degrees. I remember I was taken to the hospital by ambulance. I had a fever. It wasn't very high, but I was throwing up and I just felt horrible. And so they took me to the hospital and I remember laying there and my wife was kind of at my head and I sort of looked up and I didn't have anything on my torso. And literally it looked like the hood of a car that had been out in the sun all day. It was just like heat waves just radiating off me. And apparently, because I don't remember much of it, I started to slur my speech.
Yeah.
And my wife was like, you need to take his temperature. Now, keep in mind, while this was going on, I was freezing. I was so cold. They had me wrapped up in all these warm blankets and all that. I was freezing. And they came in and they took my temperature and was 104 at that point in time. So they immediately run out, get the doctor, pull all the blankets off of me and literally started to pack me in ice. And, you know, my armpits, my groin, my head. I mean, and here comes the doctor and they gave me a hypothermic drug that they normally give to people who are experiencing, you know, when your body temperature goes down to try to save my life. I mean, I was at a level 1 trauma center, which is probably the only reason I survived. But my wife said later that the nurse manager kind of came in and grabbed her and took her out into the hall while they were working on me. And talk about sensitivity. She says to my wife, well, my fever was 108 degrees at that time. She said, I've only seen one other person with a fever of 108 degrees and they didn't survive. Like, why would you say that? You know, why did you it's say like, that to the wife of somebody
out.
Who,
yeah,
yeah. It's like, well, prepare yourself, you know, I mean, and the
that
next
person
thing I know,
wasn't
I woke
Terry.
Up in intensive care unit.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, that person wasn't Terry, right? That's the, oh my goodness.
Yeah. Like really sensitive. There you go.
Yeah.
That's why you're in management.
Oh man. I had been out in the sun and I've had a fever of 104, my vision started like waving and, so I can't even imagine getting up to 108, but obviously as I would expect, you don't remember much of it because that's pretty intense. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. And again, you know, should have died. Yeah, probably, but didn't because I don't think God's done with me yet.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so what were your feelings? Obviously, at that point, you had to come off the interferon. What were your feelings and your thoughts as you were taken off the interferon? As you passed from one chapter, obviously you have the fear of the cancer returning, but you also have like, oh, well, at least I won't have flu-like symptoms every week.
Yeah, it was kind of weird not to feel sick all the time. You know, I mean, there's only 7 days in a week. You figure three of them, you're feeling lousy, you know, and then you start to, you know, bring that, well, okay, I'm feeling a little better on Wednesday, Thursday. Okay, Friday, you know, you would have think that Saturday would have been my best day. You know, Saturday is great, you know, because I took the injection Saturday night. So Saturday should have been my best day. But for some reason, it was almost like my body knew it was coming.
Yeah.
You know, and it would be like, you know, it's coming. We got to get ready for it. And I felt terrible before I took it. So, you know, it's just, I don't know. It was just one of those things that you dealt with, you know, and it had been so long since I'd felt good. I didn't know what good felt like.
Yeah.
And so I was excited, you know, I don't have to take this anymore, but it didn't really take very long for the disease to come back. And, you know, now I'm like, okay, now what are we going to do? And I was actually put on two biologic drugs that did nothing to the cancer, but were designed to rev up my immune system to try to find it. The interesting about cancer is that most cancers secrete a protein that basically hides them from your body's immune system. So this was designed to kind of unmask that protein and have the body say, oh, that doesn't belong here. We need to attack it. It didn't work for me. And as a result, I ended up having my foot amputated.
As we start to wrap things up here, one, is there anything that you'd like to plug? Obviously, you have a book. I think is it coming out or it is out?
It's out. It's out in October of last year.
Got it. And so you have a book. Let me find it here. Sustainable Excellence, 10 Principles for Leading Your Uncommon and Extraordinary Life. Are you guesting a podcast? Do you have your own podcast?
I do not. I'm on this clinical trial for a week. Then I have 2 weeks off. And during those 2 weeks, I spend most of my time doing podcasts. I've probably done 120 of them all over the world. And it's just been great. I mean, like I said, I'm probably coming to the end of my life, and I want to put as much goodness, as much positivity, as much peace, as much love back into the world as I can. And this is an opportunity with, you know, good people like you that allow me to do that. So I'll publicly thank you for that right now.
Oh, thank you for coming. This has been so inspiring, and you're right. Every your goal has been to spread positivity, and I've felt that throughout this entire podcast, and it's an encouragement. And I love that, because I don't think there's enough of that. Is there anything that you would want to wrap up? Like if you could leave our listeners with one thing, what would it be?
Yeah, let me leave you with one story. always been a big fan of Westerns growing up. Mom and Dad used to let me stay up and watch Gunsmoke and Wild Wild West and all that kind of stuff. 1993, the movie Tombstone came out, which you probably have seen. It starred Val Kilmer as a guy by the name of John Doc Holliday. And Kurt Russell is a man by the name of Wyatt Earp. Now, Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp were two living, breathing human beings who actually walked on the face of the earth. They're not made up characters just for the movie. Now, Doc was called Doc because he was a dentist by trade, but he pretty much was a gunslinger and a card shark. And Wyatt had been a lawman his entire life. But these two men from absolutely divergent backgrounds formed this very close friendship. And at the very end of the movie, Doc is dying at a sanitarium in Glenwood Springs, Colorado, which is about 3 hours from my house. And the real Doc Holliday died in that sanitarium, and he's buried in the Glenwood Springs Cemetery. And Wyatt, at this point in his life, is destitute. He has no money, he has no job, he has no prospects for a job. So every day he comes to play cards with Doc, and the two men pass the time that way. And in this scene, they're talking about what they want out of life. And Doc says, I was in love with my cousin when I was young, but she joined a convent over the affair, but she's all that I ever wanted. And he looks at Wyatt and he says, what about you, Wyatt? What do you want? And Wyatt kind of nonchalantly says, you know, I just want to lead a normal life. And Doc looks at him and says, there's no normal. There's just life, and get on with living yours. I have seen people, and I'm sure you have too, you know, who are just kind of sitting back and saying, well, If this happens, then I'll have a normal life. Or if that happens, then I'll be successful. Or if this happens, you know, then I'll be influential. Don't wait. I'm telling you right now, don't wait on your life to happen. Go out, find the reason you were put on the face of this earth and live that reason. Because if you do, and I said this before, if you do that at the end of your life, you'll be so much happier and have so much more peace. And I'll end it at that.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you, Terry.
Thank you, PJ. I appreciate it.